despite her sins. The way he'd looked at her always made her want to be better, even if she'd fought the feeling at every turn.
"Your Highness?"
Rhea shook her head, the past fading like ink from an ink reed, pulled from the waters of her mind. The old potion master, Darkspell, was staring at her, his wrinkled head cocked to the side.
"Yes," she said. "It is time."
He licked his chapped lips eagerly, as if the thought of the deaths of thousands of Aurians gave him pleasure without measure.
"There are two potions that, when mixed, will create something beautiful."
She grimaced. This man had a strange definition of beauty. Rhea wondered if that was why he was drawn to her in the first place. He held up two small vials. It was odd to think that something so small and seemingly insignificant could cause unimaginable destruction. The moment was yet another threshold in her life. Thus far, she hadn't hesitated to cross any of those that came before. But this time she paused, seeing her sister's death pass before her eyes, the dark, disappointed look in Ennis's expression as he rode away, the bright blue eyes she imagined her child would wear, so observant, watching her every move, learning from her. And finally, the maw of the oceanic monster she'd twice summoned. And, once again, she allowed the world to be crushed by it.
"Do it," she said.
41. The Eastern Kingdom. The Rot. Gwendolyn Storm. Though she'd spent the last fortnight hiding in the Rot, the festering swamplands on the southeastern edge of Hyrule Lake, Gwendolyn had not grown used to any of it. Not the swarms of insects biting day and night. Not the smell, a sweet, mouldy odor that reminded her of rotting meat. And especially, not the dead stares of the corpses resting at the bottom of the dark waters. It was unnerving, those stares. Even when Gwen forced her chin to remain raised, her eyes fixed above eye level, she could feel their wide, empty gazes. Per legend, the Rot was not always a swampland, but simply one of Hyrule Lake's numerous inlets, teeming with plant life and the wildlife that flocked to it. 100 years after the Crimean expansion into the Four Kingdoms, however, a great battle was said to have been fought on the banks of what would later become the Rot. Thousands were killed on both sides, Aurians and humans alike, and the survivors were so few that digging graves would be impossible. Instead, the corpses were tossed haphazardly into the waters of the lake. Rather than decomposing, the bodies remained intact, preserved by some strange magic no one understood, not even the natives. The nature of the inlet changed, the plants shriveling and dying, the waters unmoving, the animals steering clear. A swamp, the Rot, was born. Gwen peered over the edge. A dozen sets of eyes stared back.
"Oh,"
she muttered. Gareth chuckled.
"What? You haven't made friends with our neighbors yet?"
"You shouldn't jape about the dead. It's irreverent." Gareth pulled his oar around, turning them toward the west.
"Since when have you known me to be reverent? Anyway, the dead don't seem to mind. Whether I jape or not, they will continue to stare."
Gwen couldn't argue with that. After stealing a cheap fisherman's boat that he didn't seem to be using, it leaked in several places. They'd been patrolling the edges of Hyrule Lake for over a week, and, to Gwen's knowledge, none of the corpses had so much as blinked. Generally they set out in the morning, early, heading northward against the gentle current, crossing the lake well before reaching the Bridge of Triumph, and then drifting south until they reached the mouth of the Spear. As each day passed, Gwen felt more and more like their endeavor was pointless, like searching for a diamond amongst chips of ice. If Rhea Loren and Darkspell were going to unleash an Aurian-killing plague on the east, there were plenty of other ways to do it. At the same time, she knew they couldn't give up. If there was any chance she could stop this atrocity from being carried out, she had to try. They emerged from the swamplands, the broad expanse of Hyrule Lake spreading out like a sparkling ocean, so wide it was difficult to see the far side. Gareth handed her the oars.
"Your turn," he said.
She grabbed the oars, settled into position, and began pulling, using her breaths and the beat of her heart to establish a rhythm.
It felt good doing something, the consistency of the work calming her nerves, which seemed to fray a little more each time the sun set. Now that they were out of the rot, she felt calmer, more like herself. The current that fought her every stroke wasn't particularly strong, and she made swift progress northward. Gareth used a spyglass they'd acquired to scan the bank for anything suspicious. They didn't expect Rhea Loren to show up with a platoon of red-garbed furia surrounding her, but that didn't mean they couldn't spot a small group of out-of-place Westerners sneaking about. By lunchtime, Gwen's muscles were burning, and she handed the oars back over to Gareth, who turned their path westward, crossing the lake with long pulls while she ate an unsatisfying meal comprised of edible leaves fit for rabbits and crunchy bark. "Mmm," she murmured in jest. "Good, eh?" Gareth said. "I was tempted to eat your portion, too, but I didn't want to deprive you of life's simple pleasures." "Thank you. The bark is to die for." "Now who's making jokes about death?" She snorted. Though Gareth and she fought like close siblings at times, he wasn't the worst travelling companion she could have. After all, they had Roan in common, which, for some reason, had brought them closer together rather than put them at odds. "Strange," she thought, "the way the world works." Gareth was as capable an oarsman as she, and he made short work of the lake's width, steering them close to the western shore. Here the air was thicker, filled with the drifting smog of the burning forest to the north. She wondered whether the forest would burn forever, regrowing and burning and repeating for eternity. The thought didn't seem so impossible, not when the Four Kingdoms had done the same for 5 centuries. Gwen's gaze coasted along the shore, seeing nothing but specks of white and grey. Birds come to drink. "See anything?" Gareth asked. He rowed backwards to stop their progress, and then slowly turned them so the craft would slide into the current. "Birds," Gwen said. "I hate birds," Gareth said, "especially when they shite on my head." "I like them, especially when they shite on your head." Gareth feigned like he would hit her with an oar, but she didn't flinch. "Sometimes I think your nerves are forged of the same steel armour you wear across your loins." Gwen raised the spyglass to her eye, pushing her scope further south, past where the lake gave way to a narrow strip of silver, shooting away perfectly straight, like a gossamer thread. The spear. "One, it's just you I'm not scared of, and two, don't speak of my loins ever again." Gareth opened his mouth to respond, probably with another pointless quip, but Gwen quickly shushed him. "Wait. What is it?" She squinted, trying to magnify her vision further. It worked, and suddenly the smudges she'd thought were moving across the land took shape. People. Lots of them. They were on the eastern riverbank, not quite to its edge, but swiftly approaching. "Gwen?" Gareth said. There was no time to explain. She snatched the oars from him, shoving him off the bench. "What are you— They're here!" she hissed, splashing the tips of the oars back into the water, pulling as hard as she could to quickly gain momentum, the current lending additional speed as they funneled toward the entrance to the spear. Gareth rose to a kneeling position, grabbing the spyglass from the boat's bed where Gwen had dropped it. Gwen pulled harder. The fate mark on her cheek flared, sending additional strength to her arms, her abdomen, her legs. The boat sprang forward with a lurch, cutting through the water, sending waves from its bow. "What do you see?" Gwen asked. "Tell me." "Holy awe," Gareth said. "It's her." A shockwave shivered through Gwen, and she nearly dropped the oars. She quickly recovered, sending the boat shooting forward once more. "Queen Loren is here?" "Yes, I can see her. And him, too. Darkspell. They've got several Furia with them as protection." "The nerve of that woman," Gwen thought. "How much time do we have?" "Not long," Gareth said. "You'll have to go faster." To anyone else, it might sound like an impossible request, but not to Gwen. She redoubled her efforts, her cheek burning, the light nearly blinding her left eye. As the oars cut through the water again and again and again, the boat seemed to lift from the water, sliding over it rather than through it. "You're a force of nature, you know that," Gareth said. "So I've been told," she said, grunting from the strain.
Assuming Roan picks you, and let's face it, he probably will, please be careful with him. He might have a fate mark, but he's fragile.
Gwen ignored the comment, using every ounce of her breath to pull, pull, pull. The rickety boat swept into the spear, which seemed to grab it from the front, drawing it along faster and faster and faster still. And then she saw them, a dozen travellers on horseback. Rhea, her white purity dress swirling around her feet as she rode. Darkspell, his dark cloak covering his hunched form. The Furia just ahead and just behind. The group was trotting along at a reasonable pace, unsuspecting that they were being hunted by their own escaped prisoners.
Even if we make it in time, the Furia are worthy foes.
Gwen had fought them several times before, and though she'd managed to kill them, the battles were long and drawn out. If they distracted her long enough for Darkspell to empty his potion into the spear, it's over.
I can't let that happen.
A shout. They'd been spotted. The horses were spurred on, sprinting across the plains now, angling further south to add distance between them and their pursuers.
"Damn it!"
Gwen growled. Her entire body was rocking back and forth as she strained against water and distance and time, the old boat rattling as if it might break apart at any moment.
"We're not going to make it," Gareth said.
"We are!"
Gwen hated being defied, hated losing, hated seeing innocent people die. She wouldn't give in until the act was complete. Gareth grabbed her shoulder.
"Gwen, this potion will kill you. We need to get you somewhere safe."
She shrugged him off.
"The waters are connected. Nowhere is safe."
Anyway, she didn't care about herself, but about her people. The young, the old, the unborn. All of them deserved life, and she refused to let Rhea Loren take it from them. Ahead, the riders had dismounted near the river and were running toward it. Rhea Loren was at their head, while Darkspell and his shorter legs fell behind. She was flanked by her Furia, their blades drawn, flashing in the afternoon light as their arms pumped at their sides.
"No,"
Gwen gasped. Their foe was so close she could see their eyes, and yet too far away to be stopped. Gareth was right, this she knew, but still she rode. Rhea looked at her, and Gwen was surprised to see she wasn't smiling, wasn't wearing her victory like a mask, but simply staring in her direction, motionless, patiently waiting for the potion master to reach her side. And then the old man was there, his chest heaving, his hands fumbling at two small vials, prying the corks from their mouths, tipping them forward. Rhea Loren. Rhea's heart was in her throat as she launched herself at Darkspell, backhanding both vials from his grasp. They flew back, colliding with his chest and splashing their dark, tar-like contents onto his face, his lips, entering his mouth. The man tumbled backwards, his face awash with horror, his hand scrubbing at his skin. Something clarified in Rhea's mind, a seed of an idea, a truth, quickly growing a stem and leaves, flowering into reality.
The potion was never meant to kill just Oriens. He was going to destroy us all.
As if to prove her point, the potion master's back arched and he gasped, his pink tongue flopping from the side of his mouth. He writhed from side to side like a fish out of water, struggling for breath, clutching at his throat. With a final jerk, he went still. Rhea stared in horror, not at the speedy and violent death of the man who'd tried to stab her in the back, but at the fact that she'd foiled his plans with her sudden change of heart.
"Why did I do that? Why did I stop him?"
She thought of Ennis, of how his declaration and departure had felt, the final look of disappointment searing through her with the force of a lightning strike. She thought of the gaping hole that had opened when B was murdered by Rathos.
"No, by me," she thought. "I did it. I did it all."
She thought of Grey Aris, how she'd longed for him to hold her before he'd left, how she longed for him to hold her now. Missing his touch for so long was like a throat deprived of water, lungs denied air. And she thought of the child growing inside her, a future prince or princess of the West. And she knew.
"I did it for him, or for her. I want to be better for my child. I must be better.
On the edge of her vision, movement caught her attention. She turned. The small boat skated past on the current. Gareth Ironclad knelt while the Orion, Gwendolyn Storm, stood. Both were staring at her in shock, their eyes dancing between her and Darkspell's corpse. And then the most surprising thing happened. Gareth tapped his chest, right over where his heart was. Gwen offered a single nod. That was all, the boat disappearing downstream faster than it had appeared. Warmth flooded Rhea's chest as she watched them go, her vision blurring.
Wrath, she thought. What am I doing? Who am I? These are the enemy, and I'm wishing they would return, that I could break bread with them, that I could speak to them like friends.
But then they were gone, and Rhea, tear-streaked and wind-blown, felt more alone than ever.
Your Highness,
one of her furies said from behind. She stiffened at the voice. She'd forgotten anyone else was with her. Blinking rapidly, she cleared her vision, feigning a sneeze to wipe the tears from her cheeks. She turned, composed once more, her eyes like steel, her chin raised. Queenly.
Ready the horses. We ride for Night's End at once.
42. The Eastern Kingdom, the Rot. Gareth Ironclad. Forlorn vines hung from the fungus-afflicted trees of the Rot. Mournful howls burst through the swamp from time to time, shattering the silence. Gareth Ironclad distracted his mind with anything and everything. Look, he thought, crouching by the dark, fetid waters. Even here inkreeds grow. He plucked one from the mossy riverbank, cracking it open and letting the ink spill across his fingers, staining them black. He pulled out another and another and another, counting them, breaking them, splotching his clothes, his skin, smearing streaks on his face. Gwen sat nearby, her back to a rotting stump. Her eyes were closed, though Gareth was certain she wasn't sleeping. Neither of them had said a thing after what happened on the banks of the Spear. They were both trying to process what it meant.
No, Gareth thought. It means nothing.
Didn't it?
Yes, they hadn't expected Rhea Loren, the tyrant in a young woman's body, to create a threat and then save them from it. But that didn't mean she was on their side. One act did not a saint make.
Gareth had seen what Darkspell's potion had done to the man. Clearly it was meant for a far broader group of people than just Orions. Perhaps Rhea had sensed his treachery at the penultimate moment, leaping into action, saving her own skin and the lives of her people. A noble act, yes, heroic even, but not entirely selfless. The lies we tell ourselves are the basest of all deceptions. It was something Gareth's mother liked to say whenever Gareth or one of his brothers tried to justify their mistakes. It was usually followed with, "Those who own their actions shall rule the world." Gareth threw down the last of the ink reeds, its broken stem still leaking dark fluid. He'd ripped every single one from the soft earth, and now his skin and clothes were stained, almost like a reminder of his lies. Because the truth had shone on Rhea Loren's face, sparkled in the unshed tears in her eyes, rang like a bell calling shepherds home from pasture.
Peace. We can have peace.
That truth shuddered through Gareth, and something made him turn to look at Gwendolyn, whose eyes were now open, staring right at him.
"It's time to go home," she said.
I can't."
Memories flared like red stars streaking across the night sky. The disgust in Gryan's eyes as he refused to pay the ransom for his own brother's release. His father's words to him when he was 8 name days old. "You are the shield, son. That is your purpose, your calling. Do not fail your brothers, nor your people."
"I won't, father, I won't."
The light pouring from Roan's chest, from his body, as he saved him from the mortal wound Gareth had sustained at the hands of the king's bane. It was all for a purpose, a greater purpose. "And I've been running away like a petulant child, avoiding his chores."
Self-loathing roiled up inside him, but Gareth tamped it down, gritted his teeth, stood, his hands black with ink. "The king shall return to Feria. I shall return. The throne is mine." It might have been Gareth's imagination, but the dead eyes peering up from the swamp's depths seemed to narrow, hardening their eternal stares.
43. The Eastern Kingdom, approaching Ironwood. Gwendolyn Storm. They'd set out from the Rot a week earlier, disguising themselves before entering each village along the way. They gathered gossip and stole supplies, including a pair of purebred stallions keen to run. Though she hated doing it, procuring mounts was a matter of necessity, and Gwen vowed to send double the horse's value back to the owner once they reached the castle. Gwendolyn's initial optimism had swiftly waned, as the story had gotten worse with each town they passed through. The legions march for Darin. War is inevitable with Calypso. It's only a matter of time. The Bridge of Triumph will soon be crossed into the west. Our armies shall fight our enemies on three sides. King Gryon predicts complete victory. Revenge shall be ours. And then there shall be peace. Gwen spurred her horse onwards, charging across the plains. There was no time to lose. She needed to deliver Gareth to the castle before it was too late, before Gryon's reckless actions destroyed their people. Gareth's horse maintained pace beside her, though he lolled in the saddle, half asleep. He didn't have the boundless energy she possessed when in the throes of her hero mark, which continued to flare on her cheek. A few days earlier she'd tied him into the saddle so he could sleep. She was glad for his slumber. He would need his rest before facing his brother. Somewhere in the distance, a silver light sparked, the reflection of the sun on steel. Ironwood. Gwen dug her heels into her stallion's sides and raced on. The night was cloaked in a blanket stitched with stars. To the west, the horizon glowed, the tangle burning. And before them, Ironwood drew closer, as if hauled in by an enormous rope. As the distance fell away, the feeling of a great weight pressing on Gwen's chest intensified, until breathing became laborious. It was a feeling she'd had before, a sense of foreboding provided by her hero mark. She felt as if a noose was about her neck, tightening, tightening, cutting off her airways. Beside her, Gareth stirred in the saddle.
"I'll have some mince pie with a side of roast potatoes," he murmured.
At first, Gwen thought he was still dreaming, but then his eyes flew open and he smirked.
"Wouldn't that be nice? A warm meal? A soft bed?"
"The last time you said such things, you got drunk in Restor and challenged passers-by to a drinking duel."
"Thank you, lest I forget."
"I'm here to serve," Gwen said. Gareth turned his gaze forward, peering into the night. "Those aren't stars," he said, pointing at the lights of Ironwood.
"No,"
Gwen said.
"Ore lights, they were called. Orion channelers captured firelight within the ore as it was formed, causing the metal to twinkle in the dark."
"Another village?" He almost sounded hopeful, though the prince, no, the king, she reminded herself, was resigned to the fact that he would return to Ironwood. He was clearly hoping to delay his homecoming as long as possible.
"No," Gwen said again.
"Damn."
"Not damn, destiny. Roan would be proud of you."
"If he's alive," Gareth muttered. Gwen pulled back on her reins, pulling her horse to a stop. Gareth's horse, used to following her commands rather than his, halted as well.
"Don't say that. He is alive, and so are we. That means something. You mean something."
Gareth seemed surprised by the seriousness of her words, her tone.
Yes, you're right. It's just hard with this whole failed shield thing hanging over my head. It feels like a blade about to fall."
"You are not the shield. Not anymore," Gwen said. Gareth frowned.
"Then what am I, if not the very thing I was born to be?"
Gwen drew her horse closer until she was near enough to rest a hand on his shoulder. He met her gaze, and for perhaps the first time since she'd known Gareth Ironclad, first of his name, Shield of the East,
she saw the true man behind the facade. Is this what Rhone sees in him? If so, I understand their connection. For this was not a man of arrogance and bravado, of quick japes and meaningless banter, no. This was a man of substance, of worth, of strength, even in his self-doubt and unbelief. Gwen chose her words carefully. None of us are born to be one thing, but many. You were a shield for a time, but as the seasons change, so shall you. For now, you must be the sword.
She turned away from him and rode on, eventually hearing him fall into stride beside her as the clouds devoured the stars, one by one at first, and then in large swallows, casting the world into abject darkness. 44. The Northern Kingdom, Darin. Taryn Shiri. The monster inside him had been silent for days, and Taryn was beginning to wonder whether it had died with Anis, her final gift to him. He jammed his teeth together until his jaws began to ache, and threw himself back into his work. Lingering on such thoughts would cause him to collapse, to curl up in a ball. He wouldn't do that, couldn't do that. No, he owed Anis so much more than that. His strength, his commitment, his life. And he would give it gladly, for the hope she'd harbored for the North, for her people. With a grunt, he leaned back against the load, straightening his knees, his back, hauling the enormous stone across the castle courtyard. Other men tumbled away, unable to keep up with his pace. Step by painstaking step, the boulder closed the distance, eventually skidding into position beside the others. It would be painted with oil, prepared to be lighted and launched at the enemy as they charged across the frozen expanse riddled with traps and blockades. It would not be enough, this Taryn knew, but that didn't matter, especially now. No, his death, whenever it came, would be welcome, the ground around him littered with his dead enemies.
"Yes," the monster finally hissed. "What happened to her?" he demanded. "Who killed her?" "She was on a mountain, on the edge of a cliff. And then she wasn't."
Tears threatened, like the air before a summer rain, but Taryn blinked them away. Could it be? Could the magnificent woman he loved truly have died in a terrible accident? The truth hurt him more than anything else, because it meant there was no one to punish, no one to seek revenge on. You couldn't fight a mountain any more than you could the moons or the sun. He roared, slinging the thick rope to the ground, stalking back toward the next boulder, his men scattering to either side to avoid being crushed by his rage. Except one, Fay. She stood before him, her hands extended. "Taryn, stop," she said.
"No,"
he growled, changing direction to brush past her. She stepped to the side, forcing him to stop or bash into her. He stopped. "Talk to me. What is happening to you?"
"Nothing that hasn't happened before," he said. "I lost her once, and it nearly destroyed me. This time it will strengthen me against my enemies."
"Not good enough," Fay said. "But it will have to do. Come with me."
"There's work to be—"
"The others will finish it. Come." Taryn sighed. Sometimes arguing with Fay was like arguing with an ice bear. No wonder Anis had been so fond of the blacksmith woman.
"Fine."
She led him past his men as they started hauling the next stone to the pile, through the castle gates, past the prison and the barracks, veering from their path only when she reached the forge, which, for once, was eerily silent.
"Why have the fires been doused?"
Taryn said, an annoyed edge to his voice. "We're finished," Fay said matter-of-factly. "Finished?" Comprehending that word was a challenge at first, but then he took in the dark circles under Fay's eyes, the bloodshot gleam in her gaze. While he'd sunk inside the darkness of his own mind, Fay had continued to shine the way she always did.
"Good,"
he said, a sad understatement he had meant as a compliment. Fay laughed. "Yes, it is good. My fingers are covered in burns. Maybe now they can heal." Heal. Another word that seemed to have no meaning anymore. Perhaps some wounds could heal, but not all.
not the one he had suffered. Terran knew his heart would limp for the rest of his life, regardless of how long or short. She brought him to the back of the area, where she'd been toiling for days and nights on end. Like the others, the fires of the enormous forge were extinguished, naught but smouldering coals giving off no light. A thick blanket hung on the wall, lumpy with whatever was hidden beneath it.
"Do the honours," Fay said, gesturing to the blanket.
"Fay, I'm not really in the mood."
"Neither am I," she said,
her hands on her hips. Not wanting to argue, he strode forward, whipping the blanket away in one swift motion. His breath blew from his lungs. The monster hissed its protest, but Terran silenced it with a growl.
"Do you like it?" Fay asked.
It wasn't a matter of liking it or not. It was a matter of truth. The armor plate hanging before him was magnificent. No one could deny that, not with its spit-polished faces, sharp-angled joints, and iron fittings made for weapons. But it was a lie, for the armor was painted white. The color of purity. The color of goodness.
"I can't wear that. I'm sorry."
There was a reason Terran had always worn black armor, a reason the very color he bled was that of darkness, a reason that he was so capable of destruction and little else.
"You will wear it, else I will be forced to shove 3 soldiers in it to fit the size."
It was meant as a light-hearted jape, but Terran could hear the desperation in her voice. This suit of armor wasn't just about protecting him in battle, but something more, hidden in the quiver in her voice, the tears that threatened to spill from her eyes. To this strong woman, Terran sensed, everything hinged on what he did next.
"I will wear it for this battle only," he said.
The weight seemed to leave the room, and Fay smiled.
"Good. And after you're victorious, we'll talk about the next battle."
Standing alone atop the wall, Terran was thinking about the inevitability of time. Even the strongest of men, the greatest of warriors, could not stop its ceaseless march. It devoured, it stole, it pierced stone and steel and skin. It shattered mountains and dried up oceans, and knocked stars from their seats in the night sky. And now, as was inevitable, time had brought their enemies to their doorstep. Hundreds of torches danced over the cliffs as the eastern soldiers descended on ropes. Terran's forward scouts were rushing across the snowscape, dancing around each trap and barrier, falling back behind the safety of the castle walls. They did this on his direct orders. They couldn't afford to lose a single soldier until the real siege began.
"It's time," Fay said, coming up from behind.
Her words seemed to echo his own thoughts. He nodded, spreading his arms and legs. Behind her, it took 3 soldiers to haul his armor up the steps. Plate by perfectly forged plate, Fay slotted his white armor around him. The fit was exquisite, so customized he barely felt as if he was wearing steel. The fires continued to gather to the east, building to an inferno as their enemies amassed.
"Thank you," he said when she finished.
He waited a moment for the soldiers to leave, speaking only when they were out of earshot.
"Your work here is done, and now it's time for you to depart the city. Flee toward Castle Hill. Tell Lady Zelda what happened here. Tell them we fought valiantly, but failed."
"Terran..."
He wasn't finished, rushing on.
"Tell her Anise is dead. Archer is king now, if he returns."
"You can't know..."
"I do."
Fay shook her head.
"I'm not leaving."
"You must. Someone must speak for us."
"You can speak for yourself."
"The dead don't speak."
"You've never failed," she said. "You won't now."
"No, I won't," he said.
But he didn't mean they would be victorious either. She shook her head, biting her lip.
"You're my friend," he said. "This doesn't change that."
"I know," she said, managing a smile. "I'm mourning the loss of this perfect suit of armor, not the buffoon who wears it."
For the first time in days, Terran smiled back.
"I don't blame you. It really is beautiful.
I'll try to do it justice.
Suddenly she hugged him, her arms barely reaching to his back. Surprised, he slowly wrapped one arm around her, pulling her head to his chest. Screams burned through the night as brightly as the torches carried by the enemy. Dozens perished in the pits they'd dug. Others were slowed by the barbed wire walls, only to be crushed by flaming boulders shot from the catapults hidden behind the walls. Creek and his newly trained archers rained arrows down upon the killing fields. Most missed, but enough hit their marks to throw the Eastern army into chaos. The enemy, however, pushed forward, as Terin knew they would. Though their numbers had been culled, they still had at least a 5-1 advantage, even as they approached the final barriers, and then the wall. The Eastern legions were led by a familiar foe, Bjorn Stonesledge, his broadsword flashing in the firelight as he hacked through each barrier, arrows glancing off his armour. The last time they'd faced off, Terin had emerged victorious, almost killing the man. But tonight, he knew, the story could be very different. He glanced down the steps at his men, his soldiers. For they truly deserved that title now, regardless of what happened henceforth. Who were rallying at the gates, even as the first battering ram blows rattled the great doors on their hinges. Though he could see the fear in their eyes, none fled. The cowards had all left the city days ago. These were the stalwart, the chosen, the heroes in human bodies. A swell of nostalgia took Terin by surprise. Not a fortnight ago he would have written them off as a lost cause. Now, however, these were his people, his soldiers, his friends. He strode down to meet them, a battle cry on his tongue. All heads turned his way. The monster roared inside him, but he growled, "No," and chased it away. In the throes of battle, perhaps, he would need the strength the monster afforded him, but not now. Not in this naked moment of glory and honour. The door shook as another heavy blow battered it, but it held. There was still time for a speech.
"Tonight, we defend the north as wolves defend their caves. Tonight, we rain hellfire and steel on our enemies. Tonight, we live and die in honour, men unbroken, souls of stone."
Rattling hinges, splintering wood, creaking timber.
"Time marches with our enemy. Anise, oh Anise, I'm fighting. I'm here. Till the end. We are the chosen defenders. We are the chosen warriors of our time, men who will be sung of by the bards 100 years from now, nay, 1,000 years. What say ye?"
The men roared in the face of the next blow, which blew the doors inward. The real fight began in earnest.
"Anise!"
The battle was not going well, Terin noted as he swung Morningstar, smashing it into the helm of two foes in short succession. Terin's men were determined, aye, but a few ill weeks of training were nothing against years of battle experience. And the Easterners had a platoon of Orions, too, the fierce forest dwellers, clad in pristine iron armour, their movements nimble and efficient, their eyes shining in the dark, yellow, orange, lavender. In short, the men of Darin were outmatched and outnumbered. And yet none had retreated, none had fled from the threat of death. Even when Bjorn Stonesledge himself marched through the courtyard, his sword slashing, stabbing, hacking at everything in sight, Terin's men held the line. He was proud of them, almost like a father to a son.
"Anise, I have done good. I think you would be proud of me too. The monster inside is silent. The monster inside is imprisoned. I am fighting on my own."
And then a new sound arose, distant and foreign. Voices raised, slightly higher pitched than the standard battlefield cries he'd grown accustomed to over the years. He turned, seeking the source of the sound, and then they were there. 100 armor-clad soldiers, all of whom appeared to be women, marching in perfect formation, their voices raised in challenge to the attackers. At their head, a familiar face, his plate so thoroughly polished it was gleaming under the starlight. Sir Metz.
"Division 1, right flank," he ordered. 2, left flank. 3, with me, with me.
With that said, he charged right up the middle into the heart of the battle. Terran didn't consider the how of the situation, only caring that Zelda had apparently changed her mind, sending reinforcements to Darren at the last moment, perhaps saving the city.
A hope, a chance,
Terran thought, vowing not to waste it. He redoubled his efforts, commanding his last remaining group of soldiers to support Metz's push into the center, while the Knight's other two divisions harried them from the sides. Due to the unexpected appearance of Metz and his women warriors, the battlefield tilted for a few moments as the Easterners struggled to cope. The women fought like wildcats, without fear, throwing themselves with reckless abandon at the enemy.
"We should have permitted women into the army centuries ago," Terran thought.
Still, Darren was outnumbered 2-1, and inch by bloody inch, Stonesledge and his soldiers regained their advantage. Enemies closed in, slashing his men and Metz's women to the ground. Terran tried to protect them, hated seeing them perish under his watch, but he was only one man. He fought and killed, bodies piling up around him, staining the hard-packed snow scarlet. Dead eyes were the only spectators now, watching, observing, counting down the seconds until Darren fell. Metz fought valiantly too, a master swordsman, but it wasn't enough. Couldn't have been enough, even if the battle was waged 100 times. Bjorn Stonesledge burst through the line, his sword spraying blood in a crimson arc. He gripped the Ironmark amulet he wore around his neck with one hand, while swinging his sword with powerful strikes with the other. Several of Terran's men and Metz's women released a cry, charging to meet Bjorn, to defend their leaders. There were so few left, perhaps 2 dozen. 2 dozen souls. Terran, for the first time, cried,
"Fall back! Back!"
Surprised, the men and women whirled and looked at him. He shouted again, and the men turned to run. Metz's women hesitated, waiting for confirmation from their captain. The knight's eyes flicked from Terran to one of the women and then back again.
"Retreat!"
he echoed, and his soldiers fled. Terran strode forward as they passed, swinging Morningstar in long, slow arcs above his head, gaining momentum with each rotation.
"You too, Metz," he said. "Save yourself."
"No," the knight said. "I am the Lord Commander of this castle, and I order you to retreat, sir."
He saw the moment of hesitation on the man's face, the point of indecision as he grappled between his sense of honour and the innate need to protect the lives of others. Finally, he nodded, striding after what was left of his platoon. Terran turned to meet his foe's gaze.
"We meet again,"
Stonesledge said, a grim smile creasing his bearded face.
"It shall be the last time,"
Terran said.
"Yes."
Legionnaires crowded around the enormous man, Aurians and humans alike. Terran stepped into their midst, unafraid.
"Anise, I come to you."
The voice burst through the calm of his mind like a punch through an ice wall.
"Terran, no!"
"Her? How?"
Terran shook his head, trying to understand, even as the first attack came from his left flank. He blocked two swords with his chain, jabbing his elbow backwards into the jaw of the soldier who leapt in from the right. At the same time, he probed through his mind for that voice, that connection, the one he thought was lost, the woman he believed was dead.
"Anise?"
"I'm here."
"How? I heard your goodbye. The monster implied you'd fallen from a cliff."
"I almost did. I thought I was dead."
Terran's first thought was a trick. But no, the monster could never impersonate her. He would know the difference. His Morningstar crushed another man's skull. Invigorated, Terran kicked out a huge boot, knocking another man back. Two Aurians leapt in, their movements lithe, sliding beneath the chain, jabbing at his midsection. He turned sharply, avoiding one blow while taking the other one on his plate. Using his momentum, he punched one in the face and wrapped his chain around the other's throat, dispatching her with a twist of his wrist.
"Terran, it is time. Release the monster. It's the only hope."
"No, anything but that."
"Please, you must. For me. Do it for me."
Anything. He would do anything for her.
So he did. He released the monster.
The hiss was so loud it was a shout, a growl, a roar of delight, of freedom. Terran felt his body expand, grow, strengthen even more. The monster's roar exploded from his own mouth as he charged. Men, women, and Aurians alike scattered as he bashed through them. Several blades rang off his plate, one knife wedging itself into one of the paper-thin gaps. His Morningstar destroyed at will, cutting a path to Bjorn Stonesledge, who waited, his mouth opened slightly in surprise.
"What devilry is this?" he muttered. "Now you die," Terran said.
It was easier said than done, for Stonesledge was a devil in his own regard. His broadsword lashed out, and though Terran blocked it with his chain, the impact shivered through him, rattling his white armor. And then Stonesledge was there, ducking under the chain, hammering blows upon his face, his helm, grabbing his armor with monstrous hands, trying to wrench each plate free. Terran responded in kind, snagging his spiked metal ball and slamming it into Bjorn's head again and again and again. He was vaguely aware that he was fighting more than one foe. Pinpricks of pain flared in his legs, back, arms. Anise's voice was there still, but fading, like a distant memory.
"Hang on, Terran. Hang on, my love. I am here. I am coming. Hang on."
He roared, spinning in a circle, crushing bones, rending flesh, a reaper of souls. Bodies flew, shattered, broken. Dozens more charged in to take their place. So many, too many.
"Anise!
Hang on!
Anise!"
Gaps in his armor filled by blades, his skin punctured, his black blood flowing, tasting it in his mouth. The night faded into a world of pain.
45. The Northern Kingdom, the outskirts of Darin. Anise Garrick. Anise could feel the beat of his heart in her chest. His ragged breaths flowed past her lips. He was dying, she could feel it, could feel each spike of pain.
"Hurry,"
she urged herself, as her boots struggled to find purchase on the icy city streets. The grey walls of Darin seemed to close in with each step. Behind her, an ancient army, having marched with barely any rest or sustenance.
"We have slept long enough," the sleeping knights had said, their voices unified. "From the Ghazi village to Darin."
Twice the knights had carried Anise and her comrades while they slept, the rhythms of their footfalls a strange but effective lullaby. She still remembered the moment Lisbeth Lorne awakened the knights from their slumber, still remembered how weak the girl had looked afterward. And yet the girl had caught up to them on the second day, her face as pale as the snow, like she'd seen a ghost. Anise had asked her if she was all right, and she'd said yes, and that was it. The memory faded, and Anise realized the city had passed by in a blur. Forms were running toward them, and at first she thought the enemy had come to meet them, but then she noticed the northern sigil each of them bore.
"They're retreating," she thought,
at the same time realizing at least half the soldiers were women. Sir Metz almost collided with her, his eyes wide. For some reason, the knight's presence didn't in any way surprise her.
"Sir Shiri," he said, breathing heavily. "He ordered our retreat. He is facing the enemy alone."
"No."
"As your queen, I order you back to the battle, all of you."
They didn't have to be commanded twice. Metz, almost too eager, whirled and headed in the direction he'd come, flanked by two small groups of soldiers, one all men, one all women.
"With me,"
Anise cried, racing after them. The satisfying clomp of hundreds of ancient boots fell in behind her. Anise hoped they weren't too late.
"Terran? Terran? Answer me!"
No reply came as she charged through the wide-open gate and into the castle courtyard, which was a mess of ruined bodies. She was forced to step on several just to get through to where the enemy stood waiting for them. She was dimly aware of a commotion behind them. Was Terran still standing, still fighting? Parallels between the reality she now saw and the vision Lisbeth had given her of the killing fields fell into place.
"No, it cannot be. There is still time. There must be. Terran!"
Her knights poured around her, meeting the enemy with sword and shield, strength on strength. Though the legends said the knights were the most capable warriors in the realm, even the stories had underestimated them. They were like a many-limbed beast, hacking, stabbing, piercing the enemy's defenses like rain through a sieve. In a way, their violence was beautiful, frighteningly beautiful, like an eagle swooping down to devour a rodent. And then the enemy lines broke, opening to a view of the commotion beyond. A large man, still on his feet, but staggering, dark fluid covering his armor, his exposed face pooling beneath his boots.
Terran!
At that thought, his gaze jerked up and his eyes met hers. They were weary but determined, the look of the man Anis had known, had loved, had never, not truly, given up on. With renewed vigor he threw himself at the enemy, joining Anis's knights and Metz's soldiers. Anis ran toward him, slamming her own Evenstar against any Easterner that moved. It didn't matter their size or their skill, she was not to be denied, not when she was this close. As she approached, a man nearly as large as Terran swung a sword at him. Bjorn Stonesledge, apparently recovered from his injuries at Raider's Pass. Terran blocked the attack but was thrown back, stumbling. Anis reached him just before he fell, jamming her shoulder under his arm, holding him up, supporting him. Tears bit at her eyes as she growled, "End this!" Terran looked back, surprised, and it broke her heart to see the wounds on his face, which were likely nothing compared to what was surely hidden beneath his armor, the white plates that suited him even more than the black had. With a roar, she flung him forward, providing a burst of momentum. Simultaneously, he swung his Morningstar, which slammed into Stonesledge's helm, cracking it in two. But Terran didn't stop there, completing another arc of the spiked ball. Anis looked away before the blow landed. With a grunt, Terran fell back. She caught him under the arms, using every bit of her strength to draw him slowly to the ground, resting his head in the crook of her shoulder.
"Oh, Terran,"
she said as his eyes fluttered, his gaze piercing her as it focused. The battle raged around them, the knights sweeping over their foes in a relentless dance of death, but she barely noticed, her world boiling down to a single drop of life, this man, this big, beautiful man.
"You're alive," he said.
He sounded almost as if he believed this was a dream.
"Of course I am, you big ice bear. You think the hinterlands could kill me?"
"I thought. I heard your last words to me. The monster gave them to me. It implied you fell from a cliff."
Anis frowned.
"We almost did. I thought we were finished," she admitted. "I spoke them in haste, but then we survived. A girl saved us. The monster didn't tell you that?"
"No,"
Terran said, his voice a rasp.
"No more speaking," Anis said. "Rest. Take my strength."
She kissed him on the lips, breathing into him, not caring that she tasted blood. All that was his felt like hers anyway, the separation between them fading away into a meaningless nothingness. Swords rang out, shields clashed, men and women fought, and Anis kissed Terran. She felt the moment he drifted away into unconsciousness, a little piece of her breaking.
46. The Northern Kingdom, Darin. Terran Shiri. Terran felt as if he was sinking. It wasn't a particularly bad sensation, especially because he could still taste her on his lips, but still he fought against it, knowing instinctively that he should. Her voice was somewhere above him, but he couldn't make out her words. He could, however, hear her sobs, which made him realize,
"I am drowning in her tears."
The thought made him unbearably sad, because she was unbearably sad. A new voice came to him through the dark waters, taking form as a spark of light, as blue as the ocean or the summer sky, changing, shaping itself into something familiar. An eye.
"Rise,"
the voice said. It was that of a girl, pleasant and soothing, and yet full of command. It was a voice not to be denied, and with it came a cascading avalanche of memories.
a witch pouring vile potion down his throat, fighting in endless tourneys, inflicting pain as he seized victory, countless battles, the lives of strangers snuffed out by his strength. The first time he saw Anis again, the way his heart seemed to open like a flower for the first time in a decade. Their first kiss, a dazzling gesture full of urgency and need and passion. Walking away from her to protect her. He gasped, his eyes shooting open. Fuzzy images projected overhead, blanketed by smatters of winking stars peeking through the grey cloud cover. Clarifying, becoming truth, becoming her. My Anis. He tried to speak the words, but didn't have the strength. Shh, Anis said, cupping his chin. Save your strength. I can heal his soul, but not his body, another voice said. That pleasant, soothing, commanding voice he'd heard in the water. A girl, kneeling, pressed in tight beside Anis, her eyes pale white orbs without sight, flanking the blue all-seeing eye marked on her forehead. I can tend to his wounds, another familiar voice said. Sir Metz, his blonde straw-like hair as ruffled and out of place as Terrin had ever seen it. A woman was beside him, and there was something familiar about her, too, like she was more than a woman, a memory. She said, I will help. I have training in healing, too. From the time I looked after my mistress as she aged. Terrin's lips tried to move again.
Do I know you?
But Anis shushed him. Later, she said.
47. The Northern Kingdom, Darin. Sir Christoph Metz. Private Sheary had been a great help tending to Terrin's wounds, which were numerous. He wasn't out of the blizzard yet, but he had a fighting chance. The man's strength would serve him well now. Although the Queen had hovered like a concerned hummingbird the entire time they treated the knight, he'd eventually had to insist she leave and let the man sleep. He'd promised to inform her of any change to his condition, or if he woke up. Private Sheary slumped down in a chair, looking exhausted. Sir Metz had the urge to do the same, but he knew slumping wasn't an action befitting a captain. Plus, there was more work to do. He needed to take roll of the dead members of his battalion, who were many. The thought of so many dead because of his decision made his heart ache, but at the same time he felt an odd sense of relief that Private Sheary had come out on the other end without serious injury. "Can you stay with our patient while I tend to other business?" he asked, maintaining a formal tone. He was growing more accustomed to hearing her speak to him informally in private, but still wasn't that comfortable doing so himself.
"Christoph,"
she said, her voice low and raspy. "Captain Metz, please," he said, though he felt tingly all over when she called him by his first name.
"I need you to be Christoph right now," she said. "Please."
Though he didn't exactly understand what she meant, he could not refuse her, not in this moment. "Yes." He recalled her first name, though he'd never used it. "Mona." The name tasted good on his tongue, almost sweet. Strange, he thought. Names shouldn't have a taste.
"Hold me,"
she said. He froze.
I shouldn't. I can't.
She stood, stepped closer, her hands bridging the chasm between them. He tensed, waiting for her touch, that feeling of spiders on his skin, trying to bear it without flinching so he wouldn't offend the woman who was beginning to mean a lot to him. And then her arms were around him, her warmth sliding against his, her dark hair brushing his cheeks, the crown of her head nestled against his neck. She tilted her head back and kissed the soft skin there tenderly, sending electricity through the whole of his body. There was no feeling of spiders. And then, even more to his surprise, he wrapped his arms around her and pulled her to him, his lips brushing her hair.
"Thank you,"
she said into the hollow in his neck.
"You're welcome,"
he said, although he felt, perhaps, he should be the one thanking her. 48. The Northern Kingdom, Darin. Terrin Sheary. Terin awoke to darkness, wearing a broad smile on his face. He'd had the most wonderful dream. A sound snapped.